Hello and welcome to The Pulse, coming to you in a slightly different form to usual. We're here broadcasting over the internet, unfortunately not in our studios just at the minute, but we will be next week, fingers crossed. So I'm Ben, and joining me today we have April and Rory, who are new to URN and The Pulse, and so we're going to have a quick look through today's big stories. So we're going to be talking about the food that students have been given whilst in isolation at university. We'll also be talking about how pubs and bars will be able to keep up with the new restrictions imposed by the government that come into force tomorrow. And we'll also be looking at food waste as well, because a new report suggests that households could save over £850 a year by cutting down on their food waste. So first of all, we're going to throw it over to April, who is going to talk about the new restrictions on pubs that are coming in.
This is after Boris Johnson announced that the 10 p.m. curfew will continue, and in these high alert areas, which Nottingham is one, the rule of six only applies in outdoor areas. And so if you're going with a group of people not from your household to a pub or a bar or a cafe, then you're not supposed to sit inside if they're not from your household. And it's just a bit interesting, I found, because even at the moment, like, it's getting towards winter, it's cold, if it's raining, nobody's going to want to sit outside. And like, the government haven't announced how they're going to implement this. You know, they can't be questioning everybody. Do you live together? People could easily just lie. And people are going to want to sit inside when it's freezing cold and raining in the winter.
So yeah, I think that's, you know, I think that's definitely the big question that we're looking at here, is how can, within the rules, kind of pubs and bars kind of check that people are from the same household? You know, especially kind of in Nottingham, where it's a student area, you know, households aren't generally just people in family bubble, in family units. There aren't like parents, mum and dad and the kids. You know, it's people who are all the same age who are living in, you know, in shared houses. So obviously that's, you know, the really difficult thing there. And it's not like people kind of carry around proof of address, you know, with everything being digital these days. It's not like you have, you know, like a water bill or something, you know, they can just like whip out, you know, with the at the bouncers. And so I think that is definitely kind of the big kind of issue here. And I think, obviously, households being banned from meeting together has become part of the government's approach to tackling coronavirus. And surely, as cases rise, people kind of need to listen to that and not mix between households. And if we don't do that, maybe we'll end up in the same situation as Liverpool, where they basically ban us from like mixing entirely and close down the pubs anyway.
Yeah, I think it's good that at least, you know, the pubs are still open. You know, they must be very grateful they can still run their business in some way, even though it is obviously going to be adapted and harder for them to still make money, because like, people are going to be less inclined to go if they're going to get questioned about if they live together. So the pubs and bars aren't going to be questioning everybody, you know, rigorously.
It's definitely a bit of a fat, and you think, is that worth it? Are people just going to stay at home? Probably, I think.
Yeah, and I guess in people's homes, it's slightly more difficult to even, you know, kind of regulate whether or not people are kind of mixing between households. And I think, in some extent, it all seems a bit weird that you can, like, you're supposedly meant to stick within your household when you go to the pub. But then, I mean, in some places where the social distancing is quite limited, you can be, you know, less like a meter away from someone who's not in your household anyway. So I guess is kind of what is, so obviously there's kind of like a point to it that, you know, people are meant to socialize, but I think it's slightly more, you know, easier said than done.
Yeah, definitely. I just think it's not a feasible situation. You've just got to hope people will follow the rules, but I think they've accepted a lot of people won't, so it's a really difficult situation, I think.
Do you think the government has kind of, like you said, do you think the government has kind of planned out for people to not follow the rules when they're kind of coming up with these rules then?
I don't know. Probably not. I mean, I think with the case of Nottingham, because so many students have got the virus, they're probably you know, they're thinking maybe that's not as serious as places like Liverpool, because our case is 100,000. That's still the highest in the country. Yeah, because it's a student population have got it, it's less serious. So I think they've sort of realised people in Nottingham are just not going to follow it, regardless if it's very high or just high.
Yeah, I think Nottingham has got a lot of, you know, the blame has been on the students, and most of the virus has been with students. But I mean, it's not just students to blame. Like, the government had the Eat Out to Help Out scheme, and this is kind of the opposite of don't mix with people from outside your home when you go to restaurants. It's just kind of like a lot of mixed messages.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I think that's making people like more confused about what even are the rules. Even if you wanted to really follow the rules, like, what are the rules I'm supposed to follow?
Yeah, and I think that's kind of has been levelled at the government throughout the whole kind of pandemic. It's kind of mixed messaging. What are we supposed to do? It's very kind of contradictory in some places. And I guess kind of just to bring it back round to kind of the student aspect, I saw kind of a map of Nottingham the other day that highlighted where the number of cases were, and it's Nottingham was kind of, It was high for most of the city, but not massively high. But then when you kind of centred in on the kind of areas with the students, so basically like Lenton, University Park, and also when the Nottingham Trent campus is, when you kind of look at those areas, then the rate for the number of cases was absolutely off the scale. So I think that maybe in a city kind of like with 50,000 students, it's going to be them coming back to university is going to have quite an impact, but I think it's probably taken everyone like quite by surprise how quickly the number of cases in Nottingham have absolutely skyrocketed.
It has been very quick, and I think it is the concentration of people that has really done it, you know, because Nottingham's not a massive city, but there's so many students, so everyone is around everyone, and it just spreads so fast, I think, and that's why it's been in the last sort of couple of weeks where it's gone up so fast.
Yeah, and like with students going back home, or you know, when they first came from their homes all across the country, like the fact there's two universities that's like twice as many students as other university sort of towns, and they couldn't, I don't know what they was expecting, like students are coming from all over the country, potentially bringing the virus from all over the country. And then, like you said, everyone's in such close proximity with everyone else that, of course, it was going to spread within the student population.
So in that case, do you think the government could maybe, you know, have done more to kind of stop students catching the virus? Obviously, it's, you know, not as serious for many of them as it is for older people. But do you think the uni could kind of be looking more towards, you know, online learning now? Now that we've got the more restrictions in place, do you think the government should be, the university, sorry, should be kind of considering kind of going more online?
I'm not sure. Like, already for me, my course is a lot online, and I think the university wants to like maintain that like the degrees are worthwhile. And they want to maintain that they're giving you a good standard of teaching, which they think is only like applicable if you have some in-person teaching. So I'm not really sure that they, like, I don't think Uni of Nottingham is going to be like willing to sort of go ahead of the government restrictions and like imply themselves that it's going to be online until there is like a government mandated sort of restriction on universities in some areas that they have to be all online and like nothing in person.
No, I definitely agree with you there, actually. I think, and you've got to decide whether it's being spread from people going into the uni or it's just people mixing their households where the big spread is. And I don't think, it probably is the households mixing, I think. I don't know if it is seminars, which are causing a huge spread. So I don't think it'd be a very good idea to stop that.
Yeah, I guess it's, I think in some aspects, kind of online, in-person teaching can be rather a bit of a hassle, because I've been talking kind of with seminar tutors and people in my seminars, and there's, you know, the new QR codes for the registers, which are seem to be a lot more hassle than they're worth, and also everything to do with the cleaning and everything like that. And so I think that's obviously kind of a big hassle, but like, yeah, you're right, if there wasn't any online teaching, if there wasn't any in-person teaching rather, it would look like what we kind of paying £9,000 a year for. So I don't know about you, it's my kind of timetable has one in-person contact hour 1 week, and then the other in another week it has three in-person contact hours. So I don't know what it's like for you guys, but I'm only having between 1 and 3 hours a week, which I actually need to go onto campus. And I'm thinking, like, compared to like previous years, that's hardly anything.
It's the same for me. Very few hours. It's not ideal, really, for the amount of money you're paying, because it is the in-person stuff that is really helpful, I think, more so than watching a lecture. And that's something I definitely really miss, having only max 2 a week.
Yeah.
For me, so I think I have maybe 4 hours a week, but some of those are...
That's pretty good by
well, yeah, at the moment. some of those aren't with... the lecturer necessarily, but there are other helpers there, but just being able to like ask the lecturers questions at the end of a lecture about like stuff they've just taught you, I think is like a big thing that a lot of people are missing.
That's definitely true, the kind of the ability to kind of just have a quick chat. And I think also kind of just from a social aspect, being able to kind of see other people. You know, there are kind of course mates that you'd kind of only really see kind of when you're actually in seminars or in lectures. And I guess those kind of relationships and kind of, you're not going to have this year. You're not going to be able to kind of just ask someone what you need to do for this, ask for help on this or that. And so I guess that kind of social aspect of lectures has definitely disappeared. And I think that might be, you know, a bit sad that, you know, if people kind of aren't getting out the house as much as they used to.
No, I think that's definitely a point. And even in seminars, I found that it's not the same, you know, having to sit on your own desk, just answer questions that they ask you. There's not really that collaborative work ethic that was there last year, I found.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And also the number of people in seminars as well. It's kind of like between 2 or 4. I think the average for my seminar so far has been about 3 people. And my friend earlier today had a one-on-one seminar. I mean, like that's like great for like attention point of view. But from kind of just a general kind of being able to talk with people kind of point of view, it's not as fun. And I kind of miss being able to kind of just, you know, talk with people and kind of work on projects and stuff like that.
Yeah, and just casually talking about the work that you're doing, like discussing it with other people, does help you understand things more. And I'm finding that like my workshops that I have been to, I think one of them, the lecturer said there was meant to be like 40 people and there was like about 7.
Yeah.
So people aren't even necessarily going to these sessions because they know there's not going to be the other people there. And then because people know, they know, and then no one really turns up. And it's kind of like, there's no collaborative work or just like the casual question, which like sometimes might seem a bit stupid if you were to like ask the lecturer through like some online question session.
Yeah, when there's like 100 other people there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, we'll have to see what happens with that and whether or not the increased government restrictions will affect on our teaching. But now moving on to our next story this evening, and that's going to be about another one about coronavirus, but also about students isolating and the support that they've been receiving. So universities are facing anger from students over the conditions some of them have faced while self-isolating in campus accommodation. Students have criticised the cost and quality of food provided to them by universities whilst in isolation. Undergraduates say food parcels have often been filled with junk food, meaning they've had to request fresh fruit and vegetables from their parents. Institutions said they were working hard to provide students with supplies. People told to self-isolate because of coronavirus must stay at home for at least 10 days, under rules now punishable by fines. So first year economics and politics student, Tess Bailey, began a social media campaign after hearing of especially poor conditions for those isolating on her campus. Out-of-date food and a lack of catering for dietary and religious requirements are among the complaints which have been sent to the University of Edinburgh. And there's a quote saying, students are only that are saying the only thing saving them is the fact that half of them have COVID, so they can't taste it anyway, Mrs. Bailey said, in relation to a common COVID-19 symptom. So University of Edinburgh admitted there are a few occasions where students' needs have not been met. At the University of York, students are given an option of a £70 meal deal providing sandwich crisps and chocolate for every day they're in isolation. That means in total, that's £170. And in Nottingham, a student was given bread, jam and an apple for their breakfast. So kind of taking that all into account, and obviously these criticisms have been levelled at our own university. So given that students are paying nearly £200 for the whole time they're in isolation for basic, very unhealthy food, what do we think is kind of going on with this? Would you pay the £170 basically for a jam sandwich every day?
Sort of have to, wouldn't you, I guess? I think a lot of them don't really have any choice. It's a bit ridiculous. Compared, the amount of money that they're paying to stay in a sort of fairly small room and getting not very nice food, not very healthy food, which is probably something they need if they have coronavirus, is pretty outrageous. Universities have had months to deal with this and they sort of failed the first hurdle, really.
Yeah, I think they should have been much more prepared. Like, they must have known that, like, all unis should have had, like, a preparation sort of in place in case, like, a whole halls or loads of people, they had to be prepared, and they should have had, like, a better idea of how they would be able to provide, like, fruit and veg. It's like a basic part of everybody's diet, and they're just neglecting that for people who are actually ill. Like you said, you know, they need healthy food because they actually are ill.
Yeah, and I think, like you said, exactly, that people kind of need to be able to be getting better, and I think the kind of stuff that they have been given doesn't kind of match up to that. And I think the quote about that students not being able to taste it because they have coronavirus anyway is quite funny and kind of a bit of black humour kind of given the situation. And I know, especially at the University of Nottingham, there was also a complaint about the food arriving late, and that on some days some students wouldn't get food delivered until after midday, which is, you know, another issue if you're kind of, especially if you're ill and you kind of need, you know, food kind of regularly in order to help you recover, that kind of not receiving anything until after midday, I think, is another kind of horrible issue. And I think overall the idea of, especially in kind of catered halls, the fact that you have to stay kind of in your kind of tiny room. I remember when I was back in first year and I was in halls, and I had basically a 3 meter by 3 meter room. It was quite dark and dingy, and I can't imagine having to stay in there for 2 weeks non-stop without being able to go inside. I don't know how I would have coped, to be honest. I feel like, obviously now, kind of having moved on from there, and also thankfully I haven't had to self-isolate yet, that I just don't know whether I could face it, really.
It's a pretty bad situation, I think, and mentally that must play with your mind a little bit, because my room last year was tiny and horrible, and I mean I didn't like being in there without a global pandemic, so I couldn't really imagine what it'd be like now. But the fact that they're not getting food until after midday is a bit dodgy. I don't know what that situation is. It's a bit strange to me.
Yeah, my room last year was also small, like you were saying. Like, if I can't imagine, like, just being trapped sort of in there all of the time. And also when it's so small, like, and you have, like, a small pile of food, and, like, I could imagine myself, like, just being worried about eating too much of my food in case the next day, you know, the party doesn't come till 12, like, you start getting, like, mentally worried about the food you have. I reckon that must be a problem, because, you know, you need to be able to rely on being able to have food if you're hungry, and to not even know, like, that it's definitely going to be there on time. It must be stressful.
No, definitely. And especially the amount of money that, so your halls are expensive anyway, and then wanting to pay more. I mean, there was one uni, I think, is just giving them out for free, which seems like a good plan to me. I don't know why Nottingham doesn't do that.
Yeah, you'd have thought with, like, you know, I saw it once when I was back in Catered Halls, that basically the room costs you £4,000 for the year, or however much it is, and then the food is an additional £2,000 on top of that.
Mm.
And I'm surely, like, when you're in Catered Halls and you have kind of the lunch card and everything, that surely you would expect to kind of that to be included. I think obviously because our unit might be different, because obviously you pay for, you know, catered halls, whether or not you have to pay extra, I don't know that situation.
Mm.
But I think maybe, you know, in some other places where you have to pay up to, you know, £170, that's, you know, quite extortionate. And it's kind of testament to that, that going back to the University of Edinburgh, so one of the students there has dubbed the halls where they're in isolation as the UK's most expensive prison, which I guess you can kind of see that the truth in that, with it being, you know, £9,000 a year for out of date and unhealthy food.
Mm, absolutely. I mean, I think it is ridiculous, the amount of money. Like, you wouldn't have to pay that much for any other accommodation of the same standard if you weren't a student. And I think students in general are sort of the government and everyone just assumes they probably won't do anything about it because they're students, but that doesn't really justify this appalling behavior from so many of the top universities in this country.
I heard about the University of East Anglia. They were originally trying to charge £250. And like you said, like, they probably thought students aren't going to be able to do anything to reduce that. They're just going to have to pay up. But I think through, like, some online sort of publicity and, like, getting it into the news, the university reduced it to £170. But that's still such a high price for students to pay. And I don't know if this is in catered halls or not, but for any student to pay £170 and get the sort of standard that these universities are supplying of, like you said, out-of-date food and not catering to people's, like, religious or other dietary requirements is just not really acceptable.
Yeah, and just to kind of clear everything up there, at the University of Nottingham, the food is included in your kind of £25 weekly allowance. Although one student did say that once they got crisps and a chocolate bar for breakfast, although they added in recent days, things have been improving. So on to our final story of the evening, and that's about the savings that could be made if we reduced our food waste. And Rory is going to tell us about that for us.
Yeah, so it's about food waste, and it's about how you can reduce your food waste, and how it actually saves so much money, nearly £900 a year. So it was a trial done by Tesco, funnily enough, focusing on meal planning, using leftovers, saving waste and stuff. And it saved, I think, 76% of food waste, the families who participated in this trial, which is a pretty hefty amount, I think. And it was sort of suggesting 6.6 million tons of food is thrown away every year, and supermarkets get a lot of criticism for their supply chains and they waste a lot of food. So I think this is a pretty encouraging study, because little things can save so much food, and that obviously feeds into the wider environmental concerns that we have now anyway.
Yeah, so I think, yeah, like you said, the results of it are kind of just fascinating. And that, you know, you can save, then on a kind of a family shop, saying you can save £16.50 a week, and that's like, yeah, £858 a year. And so I think when you kind of look at it like that, that's no, you know, small amount of money. And I think, you know, even sometimes you can kind of say, oh, it saves you X amount of money a year, and you're going, yes, that's great. But I mean, it does all seem like very hypothetical and large. But when you can kind of look at it as, you know, £17 every single week, you know, that's a fair bit of money that that you're saving there. And also, yeah, it's saving money, which is going to be better for the environment and better for for everyone, especially, you know, if we end up, you know, going back into a second lockdown again, and you remember the food hoarding there was during the last
year,
and that, you know, hopefully there's more food to go around. And I guess obviously pasta lasts for ages, but, you know, if you're not over, if you're not overusing it, then yeah, I guess better for everyone.
Yeah, no, I think the UK has sort of become, Corona aside, we've sort of become complacent with our food. You know, we've had access to quite a lot of food from all around the world. It's fairly cheap, you know, and bringing in other environmental concerns. We can fly, we can drive everywhere, we can do whatever we want with quite few environmental consequences for us in the UK. Not, that's to say not in other places in the world, you know, environmental consequences are really bad, but for us, we've sort of thought, oh, we've got it all, it's all great for us. But I think there's going to be a reckoning, and COVID is definitely one of those kind of events, but I think there might be something else in the near future that sort of force us to completely change the way we live.
Yeah, I think COVID has definitely like made people reconsider like how they view food, and especially people who've had to isolate, like they're trying to work out how much they need to spend for food to be able to last them. And obviously, in a way, that's helped people with realizing like you can use your freezer more, you can like buy more tinned food, or like, you know, if you're having to isolate for 2 weeks, you know, having some frozen veg, you can still have veg even if it's not fresh. And I think that's a way to also help people eat healthier, like by not throwing away your food. Like, it means that you're thinking more about the food that you are making and the food that you are eating. And hopefully that can be better like for your health, for your environment, and for your bank account as well.
Yeah, I think one thing to consider here is obviously it saves on price for, you know, a lot of people here. But doesn't kind of necessarily save on time? Because one of the ways it said... that people can save on their food waste is by doing meal prep and stuff like that. And so I was wondering, it's something that we occasionally come back to here on The Pulse, is that with all these kind of efforts to reduce kind of food waste and moving people on to kind of eating more healthy food, is the kind of maybe like reliance in a certain way on... having to kind of prepare meals, and it can kind of disadvantage some people who might not have the, you know, the ability and the time to prepare like fresh food every single day. And I think that has also been kind of shown to have kind of a link to kind of people's economic status and whether kind of, in a way, kind of forcing people onto home cooked food kind of is detrimental for people on lower incomes. So I don't know where that kind of comes into the debate here.
Well, I think it is quite easy. People who say they don't have enough time, I think most people do have enough time to do things like this. They sort of create things like going on their phone, watching TV, that takes up their time if they can do it. And healthy food, fruit and veg, is really cheap, and it's really cheap, and it's really easy to prepare meals. So I think for most people who say they don't have enough time, they're usually lying, I think. But then there obviously are circumstances where people's economic circumstances do disadvantage them, and I think that maybe needs to be looked into a bit further. But for the vast majority of people, it is possible. People just don't want to do it.
Yeah, I think it's like a mindset of like believing that it's really important to you, so like you should be prioritizing your time towards cooking or thinking more about what you're eating. Like, even if you are buying some like pre-prepared food or like things that are partially made in advance, so you don't have to spend as much time making something. Like, no one is expecting everybody to be like spending hours making dinner, you know, multiple times per week. But just, I think putting a little bit of thought into it, it can like make it be a more like easy thing for people to actually think about doing cooking. If you like think about how, what food you're buying and how you're going to organize your week or organize different meals, and I think doing it like as a student, like doing it with your housemates as well, can like make it a social thing. And I mean, doing it with your family as well. During lockdown, I was cooking with my family. I think you know, trying to make it a fun experience, not a chore of, oh, I've got to cook, if it's a more positive experience, you'll be more likely to continue cooking.
Yeah, and I think coronavirus and the lockdown, I think to a large extent has probably, you know, helped us to kind of reconsider everything that's going on in the world, and I guess giving us more time to kind of, like you said, spend with our families and housemates and cook and prepare, but also kind of focus on the environment and how it's kind of being affected by the pandemic. I know kind of at the beginning it was kind of like, we don't care about environmentalism anymore, we just want to survive. But I think as time goes on, it's kind of become a lot more nuanced, and we're kind of regaining the kind of the focus on needing to kind of prevent an environmental catastrophe.
I think we've also realised maybe what caused this crisis in the first place, changing environments. And obviously we don't know what actually caused the virus, but it's clearly something to do with human animal to human transmission. Obviously I don't really know the science, but that is based on environmental factors. I think we're now thinking this, because something like this could happen, but it could be much worse and much harder for us if we don't get our act together and stop destroying the ecosystem that we live in.
Yep, and I think hopefully in the future we will see more kind of reports like this, and hopefully convince people to save more money and also have a better diet as well. So thank you very much for listening. I think that's all we've got time for on today's edition of The Pulse. Remember, we're always online, across social media, on Twitter and on Facebook. And of course, when we get back into our studios from next week, we'll be here from 5 till 6 every weekday, bringing you the news that matters to you. So thank you to Rory and April for joining me this evening as we've had a look through some of the different news stories of the day. Remember, always listening to URN, and the news team will be back tomorrow. So thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.